At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Alan Norris, President and Chief Executive Officer. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us today for Brookfield Residential's 2014 second quarter conference call. With me today is Craig Laurie, our Chief Financial Officer. I would at this time remind you that in responding to questions and in talking about new initiatives and our financial and operating performance, we will make forward-looking statements. These statements are subject to known and unknown risks, and future results may differ materially. For more information on our company, please also visit our website. We achieved very good results in the second quarter of 2014 as we continued to bring new communities to market while capitalizing on stronger lot and home prices. For the 3 months ended June 30th, 2014, our net income increased to $42 million, or $0.36 per diluted share, from $24 million or $0.21 per diluted share during the comparative period in 2013. The improvement in net income was due to improved housing and land gross margins, as our overall margin for the second quarter increased to 31%, compared to 26% during the same period in 2013. Our Canadian markets continue to perform at a steady pace as we operate in markets where barriers to entry are high and economic fundamentals continue to be strong. In particular, the current constrained supply of entitled lots in Calgary, coupled with strong demand, has resulted in price escalation. To ensure appropriate continuity, we continue to show a disciplined release of lots until further entitlements of lots and new projects are approved. We believe that the underlying fundamentals in our U.S. markets continue to strengthen despite a moderation in the rate of house price increases, as a double-digit growth experienced in many U.S. markets in 2012 and 2013 was not sustainable. Going forward, we expect to see a more healthy and balanced growth rate in home prices that should support absorptions and affordability in the longer term. We believe the biggest challenge in the U.S. right now is the hesitancy of the first-time buyer to enter the housing market. Several reasons for this: student debt, slower household formations, lack of down payment, together with a certain fear factor on the part of the younger buyer that real estate doesn't always go up, which was certainly the belief 5 to 10 years ago. The average age of new home buyers has increased significantly as a result. However, we're not concerned in the long run about this issue, because as the cost of rent increases in most markets, home ownership will again become more appealing, especially as that first-time buyer's job situation improves. Over the last several years, we've continued our focus on bringing lots from a raw state through the approval and entitlement process, which has set us up well for 2014 and beyond. As a result of our efforts, we have increased our number of active housing communities to 56 from 47 at the end of 2013. Our outlook for 2014 and 15 remains positive. Based on current market conditions, we anticipate that income before income taxes for 2014 should be measurably higher than in 2013. Given the complexity and timing variability of lot sales in particular, many of our lot and acre closings are projected for the end of 2014 and are subject to the normal timing risk of approvals and the development and closing process. As a result, if they do not close in 2014, we would anticipate they will occur early in 2015. Our land position, with approximately 109,000 lots controlled, provides us with a large and readily developable land portfolio in North America. We are well positioned to gradually increase our home building and land sales activity in the future as the overall market continues to improve. I'm now going to pass it over to Craig, who will review the financials.
Thank you, Alan, and good morning, everyone. As Alan mentioned, our results in the second quarter were strong. Net income increased $18 million to $42 million, or 36 cents per diluted share in the second quarter over the second quarter of 2013. Second quarter revenue increased 8% to $321 million over the second quarter of 2013, and lot closings increased 26% to 515 units compared to the second quarter of 2013. The average home selling price increased 31% to $552,000 in the second quarter compared to $420,000 for the same period in 2013. The increase of $18 million in net income for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014 compared to the same period in 2013 was primarily the result of a $21 million increase in gross margin, which resulted mainly from higher lot closings and higher average home selling prices, combined with an increase in equity earnings from unconsolidated entities of $5 million, and an increase in other income of $2.5 million due to a one-time asset sale not in land inventory. This was partially offset by higher general administrative expense of $4 million, an increase in interest expense of $4 million, and an increase in income tax expense of $1 million. Land revenue totaled $81 million for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, a decrease of $24 million when compared to the same period in 2013, while gross margin increased $2 million to $43 million over the same period in 2013. When we look at our operating segments for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, land revenue in Canada was $64 million, a decrease of $35 million when compared to the same period in 2013. The decrease was primarily the result of a mix of land sold, as there was a decrease in raw and partially finished acre sales due to a 260-acre parcel sale in 2013. This was partially offset by five additional single-family lots sold in 2014 when compared to the same period in 2013. Gross margin decreased $2 million to $39 million when compared to 2013 as a result of the lower raw and partially finished acre sales in 2014. Partially offset by the mix of land sold, additional single-family lots sold, and the higher average lot selling price due to improved market conditions. Land revenue in California for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, increased by $9 million when compared to the same period in 2013. This was primarily the result of a sale of 94 single-family lots sold in 2014 compared to no land sales in 2013. Land revenue in the central and eastern U.S. segment increased by $2 million, and gross margin remained flat for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014. The increase in revenue was due to an increase of eight single-family lots sold, primarily in our Denver market, an increase in average lot selling price related to the mix of lots sold. In terms of our housing operation, housing revenue was $240 million for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, compared to $193 million for the same period in 2013. The increase was the result of increased average home selling prices in all our operating segments, partially offset by fewer home closings. Gross margin increased $19 million as a result of a 31% increase in the average selling price when compared to the same period in 2013, partially offset by a 5% decrease in home closings. In Canada, housing revenue for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, remained consistent when compared to the same period in 2013. Total home closings decreased 8% for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, compared to the same period in 2013, due to decreased closings in Alberta as a result of timing. The average home selling price increased 9% due to price escalation from market conditions in Alberta and from product mix, particularly due to Ontario having a higher proportionate share of the total home closings, as our homes in Ontario have a slightly higher average selling price. As a result of higher average selling prices, gross margin increased by $3 million for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, when compared to the same period in 2013. In California, we had housing revenue of $118 million for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, an increase of $33 million when compared to the same period of 2013. The increase in revenue was due to a 64% increase in the average home selling price for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, when compared to the same period in 2013, partially offset by 21 fewer home closings. Gross margin increased $14 million as a result of the increase in average home selling price, which was primarily driven by modest price increases and a product mix of higher-priced homes closed in some of our San Francisco Bay Area and Southern California communities for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, when compared to the same period in 2013. The Central and Eastern U.S. housing revenue increased $14 million for 3 months ended June 30, 2014, when compared to the same period of 2013, as a result of 18 additional home closings and an increase in the average home selling price. A portion of the increase is a result of the Denver market, which had 13 home closings for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, compared to no closings in the same period of 2013. Our Denver operation began in 2013 and did not start having closings until the third quarter of 2013. Gross margin increased by $2 million when compared to the same period in 2013 due to product mix and higher selling prices. The increase in the average home selling price is due to the increase in home closings and product mix of the homes closed in different communities across the segment when compared to 2013. Our backlog continues to be strong with a 5% increase in backlog units and a 23% increase in backlog value when compared to the same quarter of 2013. Net new home orders for the 3 months ended June 30, 2014 were up marginally at 679 versus 665 in the same period in 2013. With improvement in all regions other than the central and eastern, which was impacted by the more measured market in the Washington, D.C. area. For the 3 months ended June 30, 2014, incentives held flat in all regions other than central and eastern, which saw a marginal increase in Washington, D.C. Moving to our balance sheet, as at June 30, 2014, our assets totaled $3.3 billion. Our land and housing inventory and investments in unconsolidated entities are at our most significant asset, with a combined book value at $2.8 billion, or approximately 84% of our total assets. In the second quarter, the increase in our land and housing assets is attributable to acquisitions of $36 million, development activity, and a stronger backlog. During the quarter, we repurchased for cancellation approximately 540,000 shares of our common at an average price of $20.11 under our normal course issuer bid. We funded the purchases through our available cash and believe that these purchases are a prudent investment at times when the market price of our common shares may not fully reflect the underlying value of our business and our future business prospects. We'd like to thank you for joining us in the quarter-end conference call, and I'll now turn the call back to the operator who will moderate questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You will hear a tone to indicate you're in queue. For participants using a speakerphone, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing any keys. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then two. There will be a brief moment while we pull for questions. The first question today comes from Bob Wetenhall of RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, and thanks for all the color, and congrats on a nice quarter.
Thanks, Bob.
Wanted to get a view. Total controlled lot inventory is down 3.5% year over year, and it looks like you're slowing the pace of net inventory growth a little bit. It was over $200 million in the first quarter of 13, and now it's $125 million. Are you shifting a little bit more towards a divesting phase rather than a position of building up inventory?
No, that's a good question. I think, as we've said in some of the past calls, Bob, I mean, we don't need the 109,000, obviously, to accomplish what we need to do as a company, but we are trying to be opportunistic where monetization opportunities do present themselves, where it's not critical for the business or there's a value being paid for the lot position that rewards us appropriately for where we're at. We will look to do that. So I think you'll see some initiatives on that over the next 12 to 18 months. I mean, we're working our way through some of those in different markets.
Okay. And in your core Canada markets, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, home prices are increasing at a faster pace than lot prices. And we were trying to understand whether that's a function of mix between lots and homes, and also your ASPs in Canada are up nearly 10%. And is that indicative of a richer mix shift in what you're selling, or is that just strong pricing momentum in the Calgary market? Thanks and good luck.
Thanks, Bob. I mean, with respect to the lot price increases, I mean, obviously, as an absolute percentage, the increased value on the lots is a higher percentage on lots. And therefore, when the house is going up, if most of it residuals, but it goes into the house, it's a smaller percentage on the house price, just because of the land components, maybe 35% of the ultimate finished house price. So most of it would be on the land side, which then translates into the same dollar amount probably coming through on the house, which is obviously a slightly smaller percentage just because of the denominator. Is that, I think that's what you're asking. If there's any
right.
confusion, I don't hesitate to get back to this. But I think that's, I mean, if a lot price goes up $20,000, I mean, that could well be a 10% increase on the lot. But obviously, it might only be a 5% increase or a 4% increase on the house.
Well, so that's why we were asking, because it looks like home prices are actually outpacing the growth in lot prices.
On the absolute dollar amount, you mean?
On a percentage basis.
Well, in some cases, there could be some mix in there as well. I mean, there was a few amenity lots and et cetera, and a few amenity that type of stuff. So we can get back on specifics. I don't have it right at the tip of my tongue, but Craig, did you have anything else?
Yeah, I think it's what you both said in terms of mix. Obviously, on the house prices we mentioned, you had a higher component of Ontario as well, which would drive up the house price because those are a more expensive home. In terms of the lots, we've had meaningful price increases, obviously higher price increases out of Calgary, as Alan mentioned, versus Edmonton. And so, that will depend on the mix between Calgary and Edmonton.
I mean, I think on an overall basis, we're obviously very comfortable with where we're at from a Calgary, Edmonton, and Toronto. I mean, from a Canadian perspective, that's the overriding thing. On an apples-to-apples basis, I would say that the direction has been up in all three markets, just to give you that indication.
And you expect that strong pricing momentum, it sounds like, to continue in 2H, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think, not to maybe necessarily continue on that trajectory as much. I mean, I think obviously there's a constrained supply situation in one of the markets, which as we get that resolved, it should bring more moderation to the pricing.
Nice quarter. Good luck.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Will Randall of Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys, and congrats on the quarter.
Thanks, Will.
In terms of your Canadian land margin, almost seems like year-on-year acceleration. Not sure if it's mix-driven, but also California, picking up a little bit. How should we think about the pace of land sale margins? I know it can be choppy, as well as the pace of land sales in the second half of 14.
From a Canadian point of view, it should be a fairly steady state, I would say. There's nothing, not too much volatility there. I think the only issue from a California point of view is it could be, as we've said in the past, a lot of the stuff in California is opening up some new communities, so it's back-end loaded, and it depends on literally getting the servicing. The entitlements are all there. It's just a question of physically getting the infrastructure and the services into the lots such that we can accomplish the sale. All of the lots are under contract. For the most part, and it's really just a question of getting to a finished state. So that's really the situation in California, I would say.
And just on the pace front, I mean, in the first half, your land sales have been a bit lower than the first half of last year for obvious reasons. How should we think about the second half? Should that also be lower year on year?
Which area are you talking about, Will?
Oh, land sales. I apologize.
A particular region?
No, just totaled up. I mean, you're running a little bit down year on year each quarter in the first half. Should we think about it kind of that same down, call it $10 million a quarter to $20 million in the second half each quarter, year on year?
Well, this is Craig. I think in terms of lot sales, obviously, at the end of last year, we gave unit count guidance. We don't update that throughout the year. But I think in terms of Canada lot sales, as we did mention, we are getting marginally better gross margin, but it is a more measured pace. And so, yeah, we could be, the actual unit count could be off marginally from that original unit count guidance. But as we said, we've made it up in margin. In terms of the other regions, it'll really depend, as Alan mentioned. A lot of those lot sales that we are looking to occur are scheduled to happen very near the end of the year. And so there's always the chance that they could slide.
Got it. And just as a follow-up, your central and eastern segment in terms of housing gross margins, how much do you think your overhead carry, I believe it's above average, is distorting your gross margin? What do you think the run rate is once those communities are firing it?
Yeah, I think you see that in central and eastern lot sales in particular, where we're not selling enough yet to really hit the full carry cost. In terms of the housing margin, I'm not sure it's as much impacted. I think to some extent that's just the lower margin region.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously on the gross side, on the gross margin in particular, I mean, obviously that's pre SG&A. So. From that point of view. But obviously, D.C. is probably a little bit slower, as Craig alluded to through his comments. There's no question that the D.C. market, I think most builders are experiencing a softening in the D.C. market right now, just from a government perspective and some of the uncertainty surrounding that. And really, from a Colorado point of view, we're still, you know, getting our legs there with respect to our housing initiatives and our housing business. So we're comfortable we're going to get there. But the one market that's probably a bit softer is the DC market, I would suggest, on that front.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Will.
The next question comes from Sam McGovern of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my questions. Continuing on the land sale questions, you know, when you think about sort of the areas of housing that are softening, have you seen any sort of related pullback from the builders in terms of demand for land at this point?
Yeah, that's good question, Sam. I'll run through a couple of the regions from a U.S. point of view and just give you the flavor of the month with this, what's going on. I mean, I would say from a California point of view, I mean, we sold some lots there just at the end of the quarter, for instance. That was Inland Empire type lots. The communities I was touching on there that we have coming on towards the end of the year, we've got a number of phases that are coming on in those communities in Southern California, which are under contract, and we haven't had any real hesitation from the point of view of the builders. They've got earnest money up in most cases as we speak, finishing off some DD, but we don't see any problems there at this point. I switch into Austin. Again, we've got a couple of communities coming on there. We've got the lots under contract. We're seeing no hesitation with respect to closing on those. Again, it's just a function of getting them serviced so that we can actually physically close the contracts. Phoenix, I would say, is a tale of a few different stories. I would say in our Eastmark project, we've seen some builders who are continuing to do okay and other builders who are struggling a little bit. So that market, as we've touched on before, has flattened out because of the significant appreciation last year. But we are seeing some builders who are still being successful and others who have decided to move on. So it's a little bit of a tale of two different types of situations, but we're still on track from what we're planning in the Phoenix market. But there are some guys who are choosing to back off because they think things have flattened out a little bit too much.
Got it. And just on the stock buybacks, you guys are about, I think, a little bit more than a quarter of the way through the normal course issuer bid. You know, how do you think about, you know, whether you want to scale that up over time or versus invest using that money to invest in the business?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we also look at the buyback as a form of capital allocation. I mean, it's really, I mean, obviously the alternative is to continue to go out there and buy some other assets, but we think we're obviously buying our own assets at what we believe is a very, very attractive price. We're betwixt and between with respect to the quantum. I mean, we're all well aware of the public float. I mean, we have a major shareholder that's got about 68% of the company. We have 32% public float. And obviously, the more we do on the buyback, obviously, the more we impinge upon the public float. So we're trying to strike a healthy balance that show confidence because we think it's a tremendous buy. Anyway, I mean, obviously, even when we initiated it, it was a higher stock price than where we are today. And obviously, the returns are even higher at the pricing that we're at this point in time, in our opinion. So it's we're trying to strike that balance. I mean, obviously, if we increased it, we somewhat inhibit the public float a little bit more, which has other consequences down the road potentially for, you know, people entering and exiting the stock.
Got it. That's helpful. And just a housekeeping question. What was total liquidity at the end of the quarter?
Approximately $1 billion between cash on hand and the various amounts. Craig, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right. Obviously, we showed the cash balance, and then we still have the U.S. 250 revolver. We had the Brookfield Asset Management line of 300 and the availability on the Canadian line, which is a $500 million line.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Got it. Thanks, guys. I'll pass it on.
Thanks, Sam. Cheers.
The next question comes from Joey Matthews of Wells Fargo Securities. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I wanted to ask first just what you think are some of the major pieces of the Brookfield story that is either misunderstood or overlooked by investors right now. I mean, just looking at your buyback price and where it's trading at now, like you just alluded to, something's amiss, and just wanted to see what your, you know, top two things you think are just driving that that gap between, you know, Wall Street and your internal idea of what your value proposition is?
I'll just touch on a few. I mean, obviously we are we're a little bit more land heavy than many of the other U.S. companies. Obviously, there's a bit more visibility on pure home building. We are so therefore the visibility into our earnings, much as we try and be as transparent as possible through our corporate profile and our website, and come up with what we think is excellent disclosure. It is a little bit lumpier, obviously, on the land side, which is not as predictable to many out there. As I touched on earlier on the normal course issuer bid, I mean, we do have a 32% public float, which, I mean, when everybody was jumping into the housing sector last year from a momentum point of view, all it does is if people do want to exit, it just makes it a little bit tougher from a liquidity point of view. But our story, I mean, we are long land, but we do not have to be out there replenishing. I mean, the story is that we are extremely well positioned in Canada and the United States. We've got a great steady state in Canada, which some people don't quite understand, but I mean, I think we've got a 50-year track record, which proves it up. And many can look, we've got 9 years of history sitting in our corporate profile and another 41 years before that, where we've proved up how consistent our opportunity is and our business case is up here in Canada. But I think from a U.S. point of view, we're still getting to the point where if we wanted to do close to 500 homes in each of our markets, I mean, we've got 11 markets. We're only doing about 2,500 homes. We can easily be doubling the number of units there, and we can be also dealing with lot absorptions and selling off to others and show that more mature state, which we are not yet at. So it's understanding that we are going to get to that point where we'll be absorbing 6,000 to 10,000 units either through lot sales or housing occupancies or whatever, and showing a significant amount of cash flow and earnings as we go forward. And it's really understanding and looking at what our track record is. I get it from the last 3 years since we've been the merged company. Candidly, the first 15 months, it was really, there wasn't much to talk about. Land truly was that four-letter word that nobody wanted to talk about. And then the next 15 to 18 months was a very good positive story with respect to the U.S. recovery. And now it's paused somewhat, but we're not really that concerned on the pause, because candidly, if the market had continued at the pace it was going at in the back half of 12 and into 13, there would be a lot of concerns with respect to that pace of increases. So we're okay. We think that the recovery will continue, but at a much more measured pace. And people such as ourselves will be a significant beneficiary of that as we move up our housing activity and our monetization activity through other lot sales to third-party builders who are actively still trying to feed their pipeline. Many of their peers out there are looking to us to supply lots to them as we go forward. And we already have the land. We have it entitled in many cases. We just have to service it and bring it to the marketplace.
All right. Thanks for that. Next question, more near term. How should we think about orders per community in California going forward? This recent quarter, there was a significant decline. And I don't know if maybe you could help us understand what drove that decline, if it was more of a demand-related issue with the buyer, if it's you have less attractive communities that are online now versus a year ago, or if it's a higher priced mix issue. So more of an explanation for the decline in the most recent quarter, as well as how we should, you know, benchmark it going forward.
I'll deal with your second point. Our communities are extremely attractive. Mm-hmm. So just to make that point. But no, I think our price point has climbed a fair bit in California. As a result, you maybe don't quite see the absorptions per community as high. I mean, when we're selling $900,000 homes, you don't necessarily get to that level from an absorption point of view, the higher price point. You're getting a little bit more into niche in some cases. And it's not necessarily a direction that we're going consciously. It just happens to fit the particular land assets and communities that we're bringing on at this point in the not so much in the cycle, but the land assets that we have currently. I mean, I think we will obviously be striving to deal with more balanced and maybe not say more affordable, but on a general direction. We think affordability, we want to try and continue to address that. But some of the land assets in the community we're bringing on just now are meeting a need in the marketplace, but they just happen to be higher priced product at this point in time. So not concerned about it. I mean, we've got some great margins coming through. Obviously, I mean, we're still making north of 20% in many of those cases from a gross margin perspective on $900,000 homes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. Our next question comes from Andrew Feynman of Iridian Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I saw you guys in New York in May and bought some stock for our clients. And so at the moment, we have a loss. And, you know, the story was very compelling because of the, you know, your inventory of properties that were that you owned with kind of a built-in 25% gross margin because you bought them well and not too much need for replenishment. So, you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, if it's visible yet when we might see a return of capital, you know, or is that even the wrong way to look at it? Are you really planning to use the capital to build more houses? So what I should be looking for is growth in earnings and not necessarily cash coming into my pocket through a dividend.
Yeah, I mean, I think, thanks for the question. As I touched on a little bit earlier, I mean, for instance, the stock buyback initiative is just one leg of a capital allocation approach that we would look at. I mean, we would look to try and balance. We would like to increase our housing presence in many of our markets, so that will require some additional investment, but that just gets us to a good critical mass in each of the markets where we currently do business. So that will require some of our capital that way. But we would be looking to monetize selling some other lots and things of that nature. And I really think we would be taking a balanced approach with respect to capital. The idea of repatriating capital is always one of the considerations as we go through different cycles. And I'm not saying we're at that point at this point, but I mean, generally speaking, we will generate a significant amount of cash over time, and we just have to balance off the opportunities that exist in the marketplace, and obviously anything to do from a shareholder initiative. We're not a company which is going to, and nor have we ever been, where we have to grow for growth's sake. I mean, we're very focused from a point of view of enhancing value for shareholders, and we will take whatever the appropriate measures are in order to do that, whether it be on stock buybacks or whether it be through earnings power or whatever, and we'll be looking at the appropriate returns in all cases.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm also, you know, I like everything you're doing, but the stock buyback so far, your number of shares, you know, is still up year over year, so that hasn't actually helped me as a residual owner in terms of, you know, the value of my holdings and the earnings.
The only thing I can think of in that one is that there was a small conversion of some of our old preferreds. But I mean, we've bought, as we reported, over 500,000 through the end of the quarter, and we've continued to buy on a consistent basis every day since then because of the value that we're seeing in the marketplace.
So in the past, you've paid special dividends from time to time. And so I guess, you know, and you mentioned that when you were in New York in May. And can you see, you know, an opportunity for that to occur sometime in the, you know, investable time horizon? Special or regular?
I think, I mean, we, as I said earlier on, I think we have to look at what opportunities are out there. And if we feel that the best opportunity is to repatriate money to shareholders as opposed to continuing to invest in the business, we would take the appropriate action and try and find some way to address that. I'm not going to get into whether that's on the cards at this point in time. I mean, we're still, I still think we're in the early innings of the U.S. housing recovery at this point. And I think there is a fair bit of room to grow, to be quite honest. And so I'm not saying I'm doubling down, but I'm just saying that I think there's still many opportunities out there in the marketplace as well. And we'll approach it from a balanced point of view to try and come up with the right mix for the company and obviously its shareholders.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for that. You know, the last thing I'll just say, it seems, you know, with the thin float getting thinner, you know, if earnings go up, it's not clear that the market will necessarily, you know, give me a return, you know, give your stock a fair valuation on those earnings without, you know, them being accompanied by free cash flow that is somehow, you know, making its way back to your owners.
Appreciate the insights.
The next question comes from David Spear of Knitter Capital. Please go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys? Great quarter.
Thank you.
Listen, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but on the buyback, it seems like you guys repurchased around $10 million worth of shares. You know, on our analysis, in which obviously could be wrong, but it seems as if the market is valuing your land at a, you know, severe discount here to anything that would be available in the open market. So therefore, wouldn't it more or less make the most sense to place the primary focus on buying back your own shares rather than taking cash out of the company, you know, via a dividend, as previously mentioned, or buying more land? You know, I know, and you mentioned it, the small float, and there's liquidity issues, especially with aggressively buying back shares. But, you know, you even mentioned that your shares, you know, still, you know, represent compelling value here. So more or less what I'm getting at is, you know, how do you go about, you know, bridging this gap for shareholders and at the same time also taking advantage of the opportunity that's in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine balance. There's no question about it, David. I mean, we tried to find that balance on the 2 million share number that we picked, again, to try and protect the public float somewhat, as well as to show that we think it's a very good
investment. More or less what I'm getting at is if you have the ability to buy back your own, you know, shares and you're buying land at a severe discount to anything else that's available, but at the same time you're afraid of, you know, causing liquidity issues, will you go out and buy land, you know, on the open market at a higher, you know, at a premium instead of, you know, hurting your liquidity, more or less? That's kind of what I'm getting at.
No, we're not going to buy land just for the sake of buying land because we don't want to hurt the float. No.
Got it.
I mean,
okay,
we'll do the right thing with respect to, from an, I mean, we've still got the same criteria as we've always had with respect to when we're purchasing assets, and we need to make certain returns. It's not, I understand your point, but we're not going to do something because.
That's good to hear. From everything you guys have done so far, that, you know, it seems that would be the case. So I appreciate
we have
that.
A discipline as to how we're approaching it, yeah.
The only other thing I would add that we have talked about in the past is, you know, the other thing we're obviously balancing against is developing our land in order to advance it for monetization. While our acquisitions in the quarter certainly have gone down, you are seeing our dollars that are being spent to develop the land to advance it is increasing.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Do
the land doesn't develop itself, so that makes sense.
Yep, exactly.
The other question, the last one, and I'll leave it be. But, you know, looking at the longer term here and ignoring, you know, some of the more short-sighted metrics that a lot of, you know, the analysts seem to focus on, I think it's worth, you know, mentioning that, you know, you mentioned that you're land heavy and that's a reason for the discount. But, you know, being land heavy is, you know, in our minds actually a positive, you know, considering it's a, you know, significantly higher margin business.
Yep.
At the same time, it seems like, you know, on our numbers, you guys are selling lots at about $130,000 to $140,000 per lot. Historically, you guys are generating around 40%, you know, plus margins, you know, around $55,000 per lot. But if you look at your share price, the market seems to value your 109,000 lots at under $20,000 per lot. So that's a pretty, you know, significant discount that we're more or less referring to, you know, between the real value you guys are generating, about $55,000, and the implied value of the shares, which is around, you know, $20,000. So I hope that's, you know, realized by all.
I mean, I think we've tried to disclose in the profile, as you know, David, from a raw land point of view, you can see the book value of our raw land, and we've tried to explain what we will net out of that raw land on a future cash flow point of view on an undiscounted basis, which is
in excess of $5.5 billion. So we've tried to give that visibility, and that doesn't have any inflation or any of those things into, and that does not include any housing on top of that either. So
yeah.
I appreciate your point, and that's why we're trying to be as transparent as possible.
All right, I appreciate it. Looking forward to seeing you guys bridge that gap and getting that price to reflect the accurate value. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, David.
We have a follow-up question from Will Randall of Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my follow-up, and I have a little bit of a short-sighted question. In regards to community count growth in the second half, are you still looking on the housing side mid-50s, and how does that ramp over the next 2 years?
Will, this is Craig. In terms of, I think we had our original guidance was roughly community count about 57, including JVs. I think we were at 56, so that would be about a net one in the later half of the year. In terms of the next 2 years, I'm not sure we're in a position to give that right now.
Do you think it's mid-single digit or greater than that growth year on year?
We're literally working our way through different nuances of it. As I said earlier on, we're just about increasing the housing activity in some of the regions. So, until we really go through some of the pros and cons, I just don't want to be sort of misleading until we really get our head around exactly how much we're going to be doing ourselves versus selling to others.
Okay. Thanks for taking the follow-up, and congrats again.
Thanks, Will.
The next question comes from Frank Mayer of Vision Capital. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Frank.
It seems to me that one of the problems that Brookfield is experiencing is that the quarterly report only reports on earnings per se, which is on dispositions, sales of houses and sales of land. During this period, during the 3 months and during the 6 months of 2014, fiscal 2014, the company has created considerable value, both through the appreciation of land in its marketplace and through the processing of land, which enhances its value as it becomes entitled lots in annexed land within cities, etc. So the question I have for management is, could you give us some idea of what that unreported number might be, the appreciation of value that has occurred to the benefit of individual shareholders during the first 6 months of the year? I noticed that in that regard, that of course, Al, you mentioned the reference to $5.5 billion of undiscounted cash flow. I think these numbers are only revised once a year, and that would presumably pick that up. Could you, if you are not prepared to give us a dollar amount for the first 6 months, could you give us some idea as to what the trend in the $5.5 billion might be and where that number might stand at year end?
Yeah, it's obviously difficult to try and value every, the appreciation. That's just what we do every day, Frank, obviously, is to try and bring it through the process to add the value. And I totally get your point with respect to the unrealized gain that we get from the other 90,000 lots that we're continuing to take through the process. The $5.5 billion, I just want to make sure we're all clear. Obviously, we will be moving land from raw into a developed state. So, as we go through one, if everything stayed static and prices are increasing, you continue to see that number go up. We will obviously be pulling some numbers out of the 5.5 as we bring it through to the developed state. So I think what it's incumbent upon us to do is to try and explain, as we update that once a year, as to what has moved from raw into developed. And you'll see that corresponding change there. It's either going to be crystallized through sales or it's going to end up in our land under development. But you're exactly right. What we, we are experiencing some price increases in some of the markets, which is one aspect of value creation as we continue to hold land, which will go up in value because of that. And we continue to get value creation through taking a particular piece of land from an unentitled state to an entitled or further progressing it. So there's a combination of ways of doing that. And we try to explain in the profile which ones are entitled, what stage they're at, things of that nature. And then there's enough maps, et cetera, there to try and explain. People will be able to understand in some of the markets what that should result in. But it's difficult to do an unrealized gain calculation on a quarter-by-quarter basis because there's a lot of moving parts. But I get your point.
Let's start at the base case. Is it fair to say that the $5.5 billion has not gone down?
We don't update it until we do it at the end of the year. I mean, what I can't recall is exactly how much we've approved a lot of land, taking it out of raw and into developed states. I mean, we've done a number of project approvals through the course of the year, which continues to develop it. So, I mean, we're bringing more lots on. And as we touched on a little bit earlier in the call, is we haven't quite replenished all of it, and nor do we have to. I mean, our lot count is down slightly. But, I mean, we're still in a very, very solid state. So all I'm saying is there will be some that come out. I mean, we could be taking out 300-400 acres worth of land easily in some of the regions there to move it into a developed state, which comes out of the 5.5 but brings it much closer to crystallization. It's still a very positive story. So, I mean, we will update and try and bring clarity to it as to what's gone in and what's come out so that you can get a more apples-to-apples version when you see it. If that number was 5.6, I'm just picking a number, Frank, it could well be that we took out what used to be $600 million worth of raw land out of that 5.5 number, and so the net increase is there, but the rest of it's coming through land under. So just to try and show the movement.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how many years have you been doing this $5.5 billion number now?
I think just since the merger. So about just over 3 years ago.
And what is the pace of increase in the number been over those three and a half years? I mean, what did it start off at?
Craig, I think we referenced it within the profile of the exact movements year over year. As Alan said, there's a lot of moving parts. I mean, other examples would be if we decided to monetize something in a raw or partially finished state, that arguably could bring down the number. But would be a very positive thing. I think Alan referenced that.
I mean, I'm just trying to get at what has the historic increase been in that number over the last 3 years?
5.5. I'm going off the top, right? I think it was about 4.7, then 5, and now 5.5.
So, I mean, is there anything to suggest that progression would not continue?
Other than we're going to be trying to advance and monetize and do things and create, I mean, obviously the quicker we advance some of the monetization, the more value we have for the company. So that's the whole point. And so, I mean, this is all undiscounted, no inflation, but if we advance the timing of the cash recovered, that allows us to either reinvest or deal with other capital allocation things that we touched on earlier. So we're very comfortable with where we're at, let's put it that way.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
The last question comes from Rick Murray of Midwest Advisors. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Just a quick question. I apologize. I got on the call late, so you may have already covered this. But related to the pace of absorption in California, it seems like there's been a bit of a dramatic slowing. Are there any other sort of timing or other issues related to community openings or anything like that?
Yeah, Rick, it's Alan here. We did touch on it a little bit earlier on, but really just to clarify, I mean, our price points have gone up quite significantly in California for a lot of good reasons, but just from a pace point of view, typically on the higher end homes, it will be a slightly lower pace. So I think it's just a mixed thing at this point. We're not too concerned. We're still achieving our margins and our results, but as we get closer to that $900,000 price point, which I'm not saying is going to be replicated forever, but at this point, with the types of land that we have and the communities we have, we are going after some of that higher price point, and the absorptions will be a touch slow just because of the cost.
Okay, I appreciate that. And then just a final comment. I may be old or old-fashioned, but being in the land development business 6 years into a housing cycle, I'd be very comfortable holding on to liquidity.
Yeah, I understand. We're sitting with just about $1 billion of liquidity at this point, so we're in very good shape with respect to that. Our debt profile is 2022 from a point of view of our unsecured notes. I still believe that the pause that we've seen from a U.S. Housing recovery point of view that we touched on earlier on in the call, I think I'm not saying it's going to prolong it forever, but I still think we're in We're not in the late innings of a recovery by any stretch, in my opinion, from a U.S. point of view. So I think there's still some room to go, but we still have, we're trying to come up with a balanced approach with respect to reinvestment, increasing our footprint in the areas where we do business, and looking at capital allocation for shareholder different initiatives such as the buyback. So we're trying to take a balanced approach to it.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. I'll now hand the call back over to Alan Norris for closing comments.
Thanks, Brock. Thanks everybody for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to our call. Appreciate your support and your insight, and we look forward to talking to you at the end of Q3. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating, and have a pleasant day.